So first we're going to hear from O'Neill Tedrow. He's going to talk to us on groundwater surface water interactions and aquifer toxicity testing.
First off, I would really like to thank the Minnesota Groundwater Association for allowing me this opportunity. The purpose of this talk today will be to introduce and define many of the terms associated with aquatic toxicity testing, as well as talk about some of the groundwater and surface water characteristics that may influence the responses of organisms used in aquatic toxicity tests, and thusly influences on the conclusions of those aquatic toxicity tests. I'll just make it clear that this presentation will be available to anybody who would like a copy following this meeting if they would like to quiz it or examine its contents more closely. Again, just a quick overview. Some general characteristics of surface water and groundwater, the influences of those characteristics on aquatic toxicity tests. I will introduce toxicology as a science and also define and clarify some of the terms commonly associated with toxicity tests and toxicology as a science. Two of those terms will be exposures and responses. One point that was touched on earlier was that, and I believe it was the EPA researcher, Dr. Wilkin, I believe, really focused on the form of elements that are present in waters, and that is one of the principles of toxicology, is that the form of the exposure is what matters. And I'll get into that a little more in detail later on, too. Define some terms that are used in chronic for toxicity tests. Chronic and acute, they have very specific meanings. However, they are thrown around very often and not defined specifically. I will talk briefly about how data from these toxicity tests may be interpreted and conclusions that may be stated from these tests. And finally, just recap some points and have a question and answer period following this presentation. So what we have here is just a chart detailing three general characteristics of surface water and groundwater. I included the as-collected temperature as well, because temperature as a characteristic of water can influence pH, conductivity, specific conductance, as it's commonly called, among many other parameters. However, these are the three basic parameters that we commonly measure for many surface and groundwater samples. These measurements are not necessarily significantly different based on this chart between surface water samples and groundwater samples. However, I would like to point out that the dissolved oxygen concentrations in the groundwater samples detailed here is essentially below detection. As it was reported, it was about 0.2 milligrams per liter. For all intents and purposes, that's anoxic. That's below detection. Pardon me. And this becomes significant in that EPA methods that detail and define how toxicity tests are to be conducted typically require or recommend that dissolved oxygen concentrations in waters used to initiate tox tests be at or above 4 milligrams per liter. That basically takes dissolved oxygen out of the equation, so to speak, as a variable that may influence responses of those organisms used in these tests. This becomes very important, again, because if you use anoxic water or water with little to no dissolved oxygen for toxicity tests, your organisms may exhibit some very significant adverse responses, not necessarily due to what may be present in the water, but the lack of oxygen. So what EPA methods commonly recommend is gentle to single bubble aeration for water samples with low to non-detect DO concentrations, and thusly bring that concentration of DO up to at least 4 milligrams per liter prior to test initiation. This does not ensure that that DO concentration will remain at or above 4 milligrams per liter for the duration of that test. So that must also be kept in mind. So I'll speak about these general water characteristics and how they may influence responses of these animals used in toxicity tests. This particular diagram has actually been depicted earlier in presentations. Not this exact diagram, but diagrams very similar. And the relationships and interactions between groundwater and surface water have been already talked about, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this other than to say that specifically, active and or non-active mining pits and waters that accumulate in those pits are influenced from many different sources, such as groundwater inflows, surface water inflows, which may come from as stormwater runoff, may occur from cities with impermeable surfaces. And then, of course, those waters may contain other constituents of concern, oils and grease, and they may have other characteristics that influence significantly responses of organisms used in toxicity tests. So the three parameters that I mentioned earlier, pH, dissolved oxygen, and conductivity, how might they influence these animals? Well, pH specifically may influence the form and thusly the bioavailability of certain elements of concern in your waste, in discharge waters, wastewaters, inflow waters, any water for that matter. And when I say form, I mean the actual species of the element present. And that is observable through EH-pH diagrams, which came up in an earlier presentation. And that is also one of the points that I'll make throughout this talk, is that the form of the exposure is what matters. Another point I'll make, and I'll just bring it up now because it will come up again, is that correlation does not equal causation. This is an often overused phrase in toxicology. However, those three little words become very important, and I'll talk about those as well. Oops, that little trigger. Dissolved oxygen. Again, I brought that up earlier, but the basic question there is, can those organisms breathe? Organisms used in toxicity tests typically are, I'll bring it up now, they're called Pseudaphnia dubia, which is just a miniature, very small water flea, and Pimaphales promilus, the fathead minnow. Both of these organisms are used at very young stages of life, and both of which acquire oxygen through either gill membranes or other filter feeding membranes located underneath the carapace in the case of Pseudaphnia dubia. Conductivity. Electrical conductivity, or specific conductance, is influenced significantly by total dissolved solids, total suspended solids, really anything in that water that will increase that water's capability to conduct electricity between one point and another. The way that conductivity can influence organism responses in toxicity tests is, first off, for Pseudaphnia dubia, waters with high conductivity, and high conductivity is fairly subjective, but normally those conductivity measurements are in the 1,000 to microsiemen per centimeter range. And the high conductivity is not necessarily the source of the adverse response by C. dubia. Commonly, it's decreased reproduction. It's not necessarily the high conductivity, but it's the ion imbalance that is commonly associated with a high conductivity situation. Not always, but at times it is. High conductivity and the commonly associated ion imbalance can also influence responses from fathead minnows, more so in the growth, not necessarily mortality. Under certain circumstances, yes, mortality may be observed, but more commonly it's just a difference in growth between exposed and non-exposed organisms that may be observed due to a high conductivity or thusly the ion imbalance commonly associated with high conductivity. So really now to my favorite part and my specialty is toxicology. What really is toxicology? Well, toxicology as a science is the scientific study of exposures and organism responses to those exposures, or more simply put, the scientific study of the stimulus-response relationship. And just so everybody knows, everything is toxic. Everything is toxic. There is a form, a route, a concentration or intensity, a duration of exposure, and a frequency that will make everything toxic. And I know this may be somewhat cliche, but there's a saying back in graduate school, I'll never forget, that if you show me something that's not toxic, I'll make a bullet out of it and shoot you with it. And there's that form, that route, the intensity, duration, and frequency that will render everything toxic at some point. And exposures and responses. I mentioned these earlier. Exposures, you must have an exposure to elicit a response. That exposure must be definable, and it must be measurable. If you can't measure it, it's not there, you didn't have an exposure. Responses are really two categories. They're lethal or non-lethal. Lethal exposures, of course, is mortality. Did those organisms die, is the question. And if not, did something else happen? Some non-lethal exposure non-lethal responses to exposures may be reproduction impairment by Pseudaphnia dubia or growth impairment from the fathead minnow. And again, one example I use as far as exposures go, is along that the line of making the point the form of the exposure matters, is the form of copper. If anybody has a fish tank back at the house, I would wager that if you went back to the house and dropped a penny in that fish tank, likely you would observe little to no response from any organisms present in that fish tank. But if you took a penny's weight of copper sulfate pentahydrate and dropped it in that fish tank, I would wager that depending on the volume of water and type of water and type of fish, you may very well observe some very adverse responses, perhaps mortality, by pouring that much copper sulfate into a fish tank. So again, I make the point, form of the exposure is really what matters. Now to detail the organisms used in these toxicity tests, I've mentioned their names many times, C. dubia, which is a water flea, the fathead minnow. Both of these animals are used at very young ages of life development. They're used usually less than or equal to 24 hours of age. In the case of C. dubia, at times it is required that these animals be used at or below 8 hours of age. So they're very small. And at this particular stage of development, both of these animals are essentially transparent other than an eye spot on the C. dubia. And many times, the fathead minnow fry at this stage of life do have eye spots. And you can also sometimes observe part of the vertebral column or the gut tract. So you can see the fathead minnow fry a little more clearly than the Ceridaphnia dubia. However, one portion of these tests I would like to accentuate is that one of the non-lethal response measures for Ceridaphnia dubia is reproduction rate. Many times, toxicity tests are 7 days in duration, and during that time, C. dubia will reach reproductive maturity. Now, if you can imagine, this is an adult C. dubia that is pictured here on the screen. That's approximately 1 millimeter in size, give or take. Maybe a little larger, but approximately 1 millimeter. The Ceridaphnia dubia babies, called neonates, are approximately 1/5 the size of an adult. So when it comes time during these toxicity tests to take your exposure chamber, transfer the adult, and look at that water, look in there, and count those little baby cereal. They're about the size of the pin point, not the pin head, but the pin point. So it actually becomes a very exacting science just to see the animals. You must tilt the cup just right, and they're swimming in three dimensions. So you look for how light refracts around that tiny little speck. And once you see one, you'll see them all. But to actually see them, and following that up, count those animals accurately and precisely throughout a single toxicity test or many toxicity tests, depending on the volume of tests at that point in time. These tests are not easy. They're very complex. They generate lots of data, but they're very difficult and they require a very high degree of detail. So they're very, very difficult to complete. Some definitions of terms commonly used for aquatic toxicity tests. I'll start off with chronic and acute. Chronic has a very specific definition, many times stated as a significant portion of an organism's life expectancy, or more exactly, 10% or greater of an organism's life expectancy. Now, many toxicity tests are qualified as chronic toxicity tests. The duration of these tests may be 7 days. Now, technically, if you're following EPA manuals, that is correct. EPA manual is using the descriptor estimating chronic toxicity of freshwater and organisms and so forth. They're using that test as an estimate of chronic toxicity. But specific definition of chronic is 10% or greater of an organism's life expectancy. Acute, on the other hand, has a less exacting definition. However, it's commonly defined as 48 to 96 hours of exposure. And contrary to the chronic toxicity tests, which measure lethal and non-lethal endpoints, acute toxicity tests commonly only measure lethal endpoints, which is mortality. They're basically asking the question, will these animals die following exposure to A, B, and C contained in this water? Toxin and toxic. I actually saw the front page of the paper this morning getting up to the hotel, said toxins in the water, some such thing. Front page of the newspaper, bottom part said toxins in the water concern. That may not necessarily be correct. A toxin has a specific definition of a compound produced by the metabolism of a living organism. Everything in one shape, way, shape, or form is toxic, basically an adjective defining a response. However, toxins have a very specific definition. They are compounds produced by living organisms. Copper, mercury, zinc, nickel, all these elements are toxic in some way, shape, or form, but they themselves alone will never be toxins. They may be part of a toxin. They may be part of the molecule that is produced by that living organism, but they will not be in and of themselves toxins. So what can toxicity tests really tell us? Well, they can't necessarily solve problems. Pardon me. But they may aid in the identification of problems. What toxicity tests are designed to do is, you have a question. The question is, basically, is this water toxic? All right. So you go out into the field, and you take your representative sample of field water, go back into your laboratory, and complete the toxicity test properly. Along with the aquatic toxicity test, you've got a list of analytes to measure, a list of constituents of concern. They may be metals, transition metals, organic compounds. Anything that one thinks is reasonably present in that water, or something that's required to be measured by a permit. You complete your test. Let's say you observe some significant mortality. Okay, there's a problem. Through that list of analytes, you may determine that, well, just for example, copper, nickel, and zinc are high in concentrations. They stand out based on this list of analytes. So one may statistically then support the claim that, well, through this statistical analysis, copper, nickel, and zinc are the likely influences on observed toxicity. Okay, now we know the likely influences. We can design a treatment strategy based on that statistical defense. You design your treatment strategy, implement that treatment strategy to address removal or mitigation of those three elemental, the concentrations of those three elements. And you follow it up with a second toxicity test. So it really goes kind of full circle. That term gets used a lot today too. You go into the field, take your water sample, figure out if there's a problem. Yes, there's a problem. You instigate a mitigation strategy for that problem, and then you ask those questions again. You go back and you take your treated water and ask that question, is it toxic? If so, how toxic is it? And then, based on a secondary list of analytes, if the answer is yes, you can do the same thing. If the answer is no, treatment strategy is successful, and just kind of continue on your way. Now, these tests can cost thousands up into the tens of thousands of dollars. And again, they're not guaranteed to fix problems. They're a tool to help identify statistically likely sources of any observed toxicity. It can help to identify a problem. They are site and water specific. And really, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to predict the toxicity of a water just based on a set or list of measurements of constituents of concern. It's very common that you have site water A and site water B, and according to lists of constituents of concern that are measured from those waters, they may be statistically non-different. They're essentially the same water, but one causes adverse responses from tested organisms, and one does not. So there's something, some characteristic of site water A that caused those adverse responses that is not present or has been mitigated in site water B. So they're site water specific, and to really know the toxicity of a water or the compounds contained in that water, really just have to do the test. It's very difficult to predict toxicity. Now, I show these data. I'll talk briefly about them and bring up my second point, is that correlation does not equal causation. And some of you have heard this before, previous presentations, but basically, just because, let's say, in this series of water samples, there are measurements of sulfate concentrations in these waters. There are some passing tests, and there are some failing tests. I'd like to point out the first block, the first highlighted block of data. Well, actually, I need to take a step back and just point out that the seven highest concentrations of sulfate in these waters resulted in passing toxicity tests. And you compare that to the failing toxicity tests, and you're talking in the tens to hundreds of milligrams per liter of sulfate, higher concentrations resulted in passing tests. So therefore, the statement that, quote unquote, high sulfate concentrations in water, and define high, cause animals to die, cause failed toxicity tests. Under these conditions, using these waters, that statement is not defensible. And what I'd like to point out are two specific sets The first block that's highlighted, the high sulfate concentration passed. The lower sulfate concentration failed, to put it briefly. However, if we highlight the second block of tests off to the right, on the right-hand side, you'll notice that the higher the sulfate concentration was, that toxicity test was concluded as a failing test, and the lower concentration passed. So just the general statement that high sulfate concentrations in water causes failed toxicity tests or causes animals to die, that general statement is not true. You really have to do the test, and really all that toxicity tests, again, can do is help to solve a problem or define a problem. And to do that, one must have the proper list of analytes and then go through the statistical analyses of those analytes and determine what are likely influences on any observed toxicity. Just a quick recap, some points of interest. Correlation does not equal causation in terms of water characteristics and observed past or failed toxicity tests. These toxicity tests can yield statistically defensible statements about likely sources of influences on toxicity, not definite causes. And site water A is not always equal to site water B in terms of predicted toxicity simply based on measurements of the same lists of water characteristics. And again, the form of the exposure is what matters. And I always come back to putting a penny in your fish tank versus a penny's weight in copper sulfate in your fish tank. Likely, the responses of those animals will be different, depending on some factors. And with that, I know we covered a lot of material, and very briefly, but are there any questions or comments? That is a topic I have never researched. And I will say that viruses are a concern, yes, in terms of toxicity tests. If there is reason to believe that certain types of viruses may be present in the waters being used in these toxicity tests. As far as I know, there's really no way to filter a virus. You can filter test waters using 0.45 or 0.22 micron filters, or even push them through a membrane filter, pulling out certain weights, certain molecular weights. But I think following those types of processes, one would change the characteristics of those test waters to the point where it may not be representative for what you observe in the field. So I would say, yes, viruses are a concern in toxicity tests if it's assumed or if it's likely that certain types of problematic viruses may be present.
Thanking him for...
Thank you. Is that too long?